Civil Discourse, the public affairs program of Gila Mimbres Community Radio. I'm your host, Jamie Newton. Our topic is Pathways to a Nuclear-Free Future. We're recording this program just days after the 70th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and 9th, 1945. My three guests, Jackie Cabasso, Daniel Ellsberg, and David Hartso, have devoted their lives to nonviolent organizing and education for peace and justice, and all three are committed to nuclear disarmament, that is, to the complete abolition of nuclear weapons. I'll introduce them to you. Jackie Cabasso has been executive director since 1984 of the Western States Legal Foundation, which provides information, analysis, and legal assistance to nonviolent peace and environmental activists. Jackie has been an organizer and presenter at many conferences and demonstrations. She travels the world as a speaker and resource person, and she has been an accredited non-governmental organization representative to many United Nations meetings on the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and more. Welcome, Jackie Cabasso.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Daniel Ellsberg is a senior fellow of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. Dr. Ellsberg is best known as the RAND Corporation analyst who released the Pentagon Papers. That's the Pentagon's 7,000-page secret history of the Vietnam War to the public. He was a Marine Corps officer and an official of the U.S. State Department before serving as special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. Since the end of the Vietnam War, Daniel Ellsberg has been a lecturer, writer, and activist on the dangers of the nuclear era, wrongful U.S. interventions, and the urgent need for patriotic whistleblowing. He's the author of three acclaimed books and many articles. Welcome, Daniel Ellsberg.
Glad to be here.
David Hartso is executive director of Peace Workers and co-founder of the Nonviolent Peace Force. The son of dedicated activists who joined in peace and justice demonstrations when he was still a child, David Hartso found his life purpose as a teenager when he met Reverend Ralph David Abernathy and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. David has led nonviolent training and organizing in many countries around the world. His new book, Waging Peace, Global Adventurers of a Lifelong Activist, recounts many of his experiences and provides a wealth of resources for people who want to contribute to nonviolent social change. Welcome, David Hartso.
Thank you, Jamie. Good to be here.
Let's begin with the crux of the issue. The Cold War is over. No longer do two superpowers target each other with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons for mutually assured destruction. And yet in January of this year, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists advanced the nuclear doomsday clock to just 3 minutes before midnight. What can you tell us about nuclear dangers in today's world, right now? And why is progress toward nuclear disarmament urgent? Daniel Ellsberg, may we begin with you?
Okay, well, the notion that the possibility of doomsday, namely the destruction, deliberate destruction by existing weapons that are on alert right now of most humans, and by most humans I mean all but a very small fraction of existing humans, near extinction, the notion that that has disappeared with the end of the Cold War or with the reductions that we've seen is false, unfortunately. It should have happened. It should have happened long before that, actually. There was no excuse, even during the Cold War, for having doomsday machines as threats and realities, as capabilities. But to have them now is all the more inexcusable, and it is the case. Both sides still have more than 1,000 warheads on hair trigger alert, possibly subject to false alarm of incoming attack, which would tempt them to preemptive attack and the destruction of life on Earth. There is no excuse, no justification for this, and yet it persists. So the continuing dangers since the Cold War are not limited to terrorist attack, which is a real possibility, or even limited wars between countries like India and Pakistan, which again would, we'll talk about this later, but would starve billions of people by their effects. But there's also the continuing possibility of an all-out global exchange between the U.S. and Russia, which would end life on Earth. This is a challenge to humanity, which is extremely urgent.
Jackie Cabasso, David Hartso, would you like to speak to this question of nuclear dangers?
Yeah, this is Jackie. I'll jump in here. It's really amazing that when the Cold War ended, the public awareness and concern about nuclear war just kind of dropped off the radar screen all of a sudden. When it had been at the really top of public consciousness in the United States and Europe, at least. But the fact is that everything, to add to what Dan has said, there are nearly 16,000 nuclear weapons now. Most of them are orders of magnitude more destructive than the U.S. bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. All of the nuclear armed states, led by the United States, are modernizing their arsenals. The U.S. is actually spending more in inflation-adjusted dollars than during the highest year of the Cold War on maintaining and modernizing just the warheads. The U.S. is planning to spend $1 trillion over the next 3 decades to modernize all of the bombs and all of the delivery systems for the foreseeable future. U.S. Trident submarines are patrolling the oceans at nearly the same rate as the height of the Cold War. And although it is true that on the U.S. side, at least, the weapons are officially not targeted now, the computers are programmed so that they can be instantly retargeted within a matter of seconds. So that's the status quo, unfortunately. On top of that, we have new tensions between the U.S. and Russia around the Ukraine situation. Both sides are making verbal references to their nuclear capabilities. They are engaging in military exercises and nuclear drills on the borders of Ukraine. The U.S. and China are increasingly in a confrontational mode in the Asia Pacific, where China is ramping up its military and modernizing its nuclear arsenal. Those are just two of several nuclear flashpoints around the world. And so we live with this danger all the time, and it could happen anytime. And it's like everybody is, one of the Secretary General of the UN said, we're sleepwalking to Armageddon.
Let me ask about a nuclear danger from limited exchanges, so-called. If there were a use of nuclear weapons not massively involving hundreds of detonations, but just a few, would most of the world's people survive that all right? Or are there implications for the entire planet of just a few detonations?
If I can comment on that, I referred to it earlier. I think everyone understands that India and Pakistan both have been at war, or in states of war, possible war, several times in the last generation, and still are in great conflict over issues like Kashmir, and that both sides have nuclear weapons and are threatening to initiate nuclear war if they need to. First use of nuclear weapons is a threat that they've both made. I don't think that most of the world realizes just what a threat this is to humanity at large, to the entire globe. There have been scientific papers in the last decade that show that a mere 50 weapons on each side, and remember when I say mere, we're talking about the U.S. and Russia having each thousands of weapons, but 50 Hiroshima-type weapons, which is to say the old-fashioned atom bomb fission weapons that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and which are now simply the detonators, the percussion caps, in effect, for the modern thermonuclear weapons that are nearly all of the stockpile of the U.S. and Russia. If India and Pakistan each sent 50 such Hiroshima-type weapons or Nagasaki-type weapons on each other, the effect of the smoke that this would create from burning cities would be lofted into the stratosphere and would remain there for about a decade, not extinguishing life on Earth, as would a major, a full exchange between the U.S. and Russia do by the same effect, but it would lower sunlight, perhaps 7%, to the effect that harvests would be destroyed in some places, or simply the growing season would be shortened in many parts of the world, and many fact harvests would be destroyed, world food supply would be reduced to the point where these scientists have estimated that some 2 billion people out of the 7 billion alive now, 2 billion of the marginally supplied people right now would starve. Now, how is it acceptable to the rest of the world that a limited regional conflict between India and Pakistan could lead, or would lead, likely, to the deaths of 1 to 2 billion people at large? Of course, that's just a small fraction of what is threatened by the U.S. and Russia exchange. So when I use words like inexcusable and outrageous, I'm not simply going overboard here and being overly emotional. I think that simply to call this inappropriate or non-optimal or wasteful doesn't really convey the level of threat that this capability and threat poses to the rest of the world.
You're both giving us substance to understand why the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists consider nuclear threats so very imminent, and give us just 3 minutes before midnight. We'll break briefly and return after this. Welcome back to Civil Discourse. Our topic is Pathways to a Nuclear-Free Future. My guests are Jackie Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation, Daniel Ellsberg, Senior Fellow of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, who released the Pentagon Papers to the public and has worked for peace and justice ever since, and David Hartso, Executive Director of Peace Workers and co-founder of the Nonviolent Peace Force. We began our conversation with a focus on nuclear dangers. There's more to be said about that. We've talked about an all-out nuclear exchange, the investment of resources in modernizing and increasing the potency of nuclear weapons around the world, and particularly on the part of the United States. I'd like us to speak briefly about the potential risks of nuclear accidents, by which I mean a possible unintended detonation. How likely is that? What would it mean? And also accidents involving nuclear materials. And for people in New Mexico, this is very real, because in February of 2014, the use of the wrong brand of cat litter as an absorbent at the waste isolation pilot plant near Carlsbad resulted in an explosion of a barrel which released uranium, plutonium, and americium throughout the facility. So can you speak, Daniel Ellsberg, Jackie Cabasso, or David Hartso, to risks of accidental radiation exposure or detonation? Jackie?
Yeah, the history of the nuclear age is rife with accidental releases of radioactive materials at every step of the nuclear chain, starting with the mining and milling of uranium, all the way through the production of nuclear fuel, the running of reactors, the radiation of the fuel rods, and so on. So, I mean, that's a huge question. It's a continuous possibility somewhere. An unintended radioactive release is happening somewhere on the planet right now. I guarantee it, from a civilian nuclear power program or some step in the nuclear weapons chain. This technology is incredibly dangerous. One of the unique characteristics of nuclear weapons is the massive release of radiation. But that radiation, starts with the mining and milling of uranium, which has happened, of course, in New Mexico, which is the birthplace of the bomb, if you will, with the establishment of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, making permanent the Manhattan Project.
Daniel Ellsberg, can you tell us about any near explosions that may have happened in the U.S. management of its own nuclear weapons, either within this country or abroad?
Well, yes. When I was working as a consultant on war plans in the Pentagon, long ago, in 1961, first year of the Kennedy administration, there was an accident in which, over North Carolina, in which a plane dropped two nuclear weapons, and in the course of falling, all of the safety mechanisms which were meant to prevent a full nuclear explosion failed in the course of the fall or hitting the ground. Fortunately, not all of them on one of the two weapons, but between the two weapons, all of them had failed. Any such explosion would have released more explosive power than all of the wars in human history, exactly, on North Carolina. There have actually been a number of such accidents, none of which has yet resulted in a full explosion, but a number of which resulted in the high explosive in the bombs going off, spreading nuclear material over a large area, contaminating it essentially, in some cases, forever. So the possibility of accident is always there. There's an excellent book by Eric Schlosser, Command and Control, which details not only a list, but in some detail, major accidents, and one in which a Titan missile was almost set off entirely by a falling wrench, which penetrated the skin. This possibility, enormous local catastrophes, is implicit in the very possession of these nuclear weapons around the world.
I'm hearing that we have been more fortunate than well protected. I'd like to move on to non-military applications of nuclear technology. And David Hartso here, I would particularly invite your comments as well. Should we be concerned about such non-military applications as nuclear reactors that generate electricity and other peaceful applications? David, you have been involved in efforts to prevent nuclear reactors from coming online and other citizen actions to control nuclear technology. What was your motivation? Why are you concerned about the use of nuclear power for non-military purposes?
Well, the so-called peaceful atom, I think, was invented during the Eisenhower administration, or perhaps even earlier, as a way to try to make the idea of nuclear weapons more acceptable. But all nuclear power, all nuclear weapons, are dangerous. The waste from nuclear power plants can be made into nuclear weapons, and there's also no safe way to get rid of nuclear waste. It's going to be around for hundreds of thousands of years. So, especially since we have alternatives to nuclear, including renewable solar, wind, biogas, etc. Why endanger future generations for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, so we can have a little bit of additional electric energy now? And I think we haven't mentioned here yet, but the non-proliferation treaty, where all non-nuclear weapons countries have committed not to get nuclear weapons, to develop nuclear weapons, if the nuclear weapons states will commit to abolishing their nuclear weapons. And the United States and the other nuclear weapons countries have not fulfilled our part of that bargain. So it's really quite a double standard to ask the non-nuclear weapons states to keep to their agreement when we're not keeping to ours. So I think the people of Japan, who have suffered so horrendously from the nuclear weapons destruction and from Fukushima, from their nuclear power plants, are very well aware of the dangers of both nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And we in the United States and people all around the world need to join the Japanese people in saying no more. Let's put an end to nuclear weapons and nuclear power, and develop the alternatives to energy production, and also the alternatives to ways to achieve security, which negotiation, mediation, resolving our conflicts at the, through diplomacy and at the negotiation table rather than through threatening nuclear war.
David Hartsoe, you've turned our attention to intergovernmental accords that are intended to reduce nuclear dangers in the modern world. Let's come back after a brief break with that talk. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Civil Discourse on Gila Mimbres Community Radio. Our topic is Pathways to a Nuclear-Free Future. My guests are Jackie Cavasso, Daniel Ellsberg, and David Hartsoe. David Hartsoe just mentioned the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which I believe, in addition to committing nations that don't have nuclear weapons now not to gain them, guarantees them access to what are thought of as non-military applications of nuclear technology, and yet we've just heard from all of you that the non-military applications involve very significant risks to humanity and to the environment, and of course we have many examples of that. Three Mile Island in the United States, Chernobyl in Russia, where a vast area now cannot be inhabited, and of course the Fukushima attempt at a cleanup from earthquake damage to reactors is ongoing. Can any of you speak to the effectiveness of intergovernmental efforts to control the dangers of nuclear technology? Jackie Cavasso, you've been very involved with this for years. I'd like to start with you, if you will.
Yeah, well, let's start with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It was basically negotiated by the three original nuclear armed states: the United States, the Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom. They were concerned that nuclear weapons were going to spread to many more countries around the world, and they wanted to sort of put a lid on it. So they made this deal. The deal was that they would promise to, they did promise, to negotiate in good faith the cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date and negotiations on nuclear disarmament. In exchange, states that didn't have nuclear weapons could join by forswearing nuclear weapons. And as a sweetener, they were, those states were promised an inalienable right to peaceful nuclear technology without discrimination. Under the original terms of the treaty, states that had tested nuclear weapons by January of 1969 were allowed to join as nuclear weapon states. So eventually France and China joined. So you have the five original nuclear weapon states who also, by coincidence or not, are the permanent members of the UN Security Council, and nobody else is allowed to join as a nuclear weapon state. Almost every other country in the world joined as a non-nuclear weapon state, and the treaty entered into force in 1970, those countries subsequently. Interestingly, Iran was the first non-nuclear weapon state to join. And remember, Iran gave up any nuclear weapons or any attempt to get nuclear weapons in exchange for an inalienable right to peaceful nuclear technology without discrimination. And it was actually the United States under the Atoms for Peace program that provided Iran under the Shah with its initial nuclear program. And now we see that the situation has been turned to put Iran under this tremendous suspicion that it is secretly seeking to use its peaceful nuclear program to develop nuclear weapons without any evidence to support that. And it's now being subject to the most stringent monitoring and verification provisions of any country in the world. Now, actually, that standard would be well applied to every country in the world, including the United States and the other nuclear armed states who have failed to live up to their obligation under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to disarm. Because of the inherently discriminatory nature of this treaty, India and Pakistan refused to join, and so they have nuclear weapons but are not parties to the treaty. Israel, which has an undeclared nuclear weapons program but a large, sophisticated modern nuclear arsenal right next door to Iran, is not a member of the treaty. And North Korea withdrew in 2003. So it's a very problematic treaty regime, because I think it it's fair to say that it has definitely helped to limit the spread of nuclear weapons, but on the disarmament side, it has failed utterly, and that is a subject of growing concern among the non-nuclear armed states, who have very clearly expressed their dismay at this year's review conference of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Thank you, Jackie Cavazzo. And Daniel Ellsberg, your specialty right at this time is nuclear dangers. Can you comment on intergovernmental accords and particularly give us your perspective on the current proposed pact with Iran to prevent it from getting nuclear weapons but allow it to develop non-military applications?
There's always been a contradiction at the heart of the Non-Proliferation Treaty regime, which was that as a result of the treaty or part of the agreement that led to it, there's been an encouragement of so-called peaceful uses of nuclear energy, energy production by nuclear means, despite the fact that every nuclear reactor produces as a byproduct, essentially, plutonium. In other words, it's a bomb factory, in effect, and is also, by the way, a potential landmine of enormous significance in that every reactor in every country is a potential target for even a non-nuclear attack in a wartime situation, which would cause enormous radioactivity. So that both around the world. So the IAEA, the inspection machinery, has always seen as its first task, actually, the promotion of nuclear energy, which has led to this proliferation of the capability to produce nuclear material. I think the Iran deal, which you're describing, is a very positive development in terms of actually heading off, I hope, an attack on Iran by either Israel or the United States, which would be a catastrophe, whether or not it led to the use of nuclear weapons, which would be a real possibility. But even without that, we'd see a war then dwarfing the Middle East wars like Iraq that we've seen in the past. The deal, which is now backed by many U.S. military and Israeli military men, as well as Israeli past heads of intelligence, as a very favorable development, actually, I think, deserves real support by people. It's opposed by not only by Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, but by his audience in Congress, the U.S. Congress, which provides him with dozens of standing ovations when he chooses to address them, on grounds that I think are entirely specious, because they imply that a better arrangement is possible, and they really cover a willingness or readiness to address this problem by war with, as I say, disastrous effects, which would include, by the way, the near certainty of Iran proceeding to an unlimited, uninspected crash effort to produce nuclear weapons for its security in the future after such a war. In other words, it would hasten Iran's becoming a nuclear power and on a much larger scale. So the alternatives that the opponents of this deal are proposing are, in fact, would lead almost certainly to a much worse situation. This is a situation where all of us as citizens, I think, can weigh in, reproving those representatives which oppose that deal and supporting the president's deal. I think that it's this is a case in which I would say this is the most creditable foreign policy achievement of the Obama administration, in my opinion.
And it has been only a very short time since the United States seemed poised to actually go to war with Iran and was seeking congressional approval to do that. There is a case to be made, perhaps, that it was public pressure that was particularly effective in changing that direction toward diplomacy. And I wonder, David Hartso, with your great experience in organizing people's movements for peace, do you believe that citizen involvement helped to move us toward this point where diplomacy may succeed? And what would you urge people to do, if anything, beyond contacting their elected representatives on this matter?
Well, I think throughout American history, it has been nonviolent people power movements that have really helped bring about major change, including ending slavery, women's suffrage, the right to vote, the Voting Rights Bill, the anti-Vietnam War. The administration was ready to start bombing Syria a couple of years ago, and there was just massive outcry of the American people that were able to help turn that around, and also in Britain, I should say. I think the American people and the people of the rest of the world, when they say the choice is between diplomacy and a diplomatic solution and war, and they say anybody that's going to choose war, if they have any understanding whatsoever of what war could mean, it's just insanity. It's crazy. Why would anybody choose war, which could end up with hundreds of thousands of people dead, rather than a diplomatic solution? So I think it is the American people that have brought us this far, that have helped push the administration, and same in Iran, that have encouraged the Iranian government to make this diplomatic solution. So I think it's absolutely critical that the American people not just remain silent, but get out there and say a diplomatic solution is a million times better than another war. And we have seen, I think, through the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, we have, through military means, we have dug ourselves deeper and deeper in a hole. And more military is not going to resolve those conflicts. And I've been in Iran, and Iran is a industrial country, a very much larger in population. And the insanity of preparing to kill hundreds of thousands of those people because we don't like a diplomatic solution, which, as Dan and Jackie have said, is in the American interest as well as the interest of the people of Iran, including the democratic opposition in Iran, is supporting this deal. So why are we opposing that? So it's not only contacting our members of Congress, it is getting out in the streets the way we've done in past movements and saying we support diplomacy over war.
When civil discourse returns after a brief break, we'll turn our attention to the potential for doing democracy in many ways that take us beyond simply voting or supporting particular representatives, the full range of steps that citizens can take to exercise that fundamental responsibility of sovereignty in a democratic system. And we'll start that by looking at the impact of secrecy, and particularly nuclear secrets, on the potential people have to exercise their rights as citizens. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Civil Discourse, and if you're just joining us, our topic is Pathways to a Nuclear-Free Future. My three guests are dedicated peace activists who are committed to the abolition of all nuclear weapons and also quite concerned about the so-called peaceful uses of nuclear technology. They are Jackie Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation, Daniel Ellsberg, Senior Fellow of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and David Hartso, Executive Director of Peace Workers and co-founder of the Nonviolent Peace Force. Daniel Ellsberg, I'd like to begin with a question to you on the issue of nuclear secrets. If I recall correctly, you have said in the past that on reflection, you think that had you released papers you had in your safe before you released the Pentagon papers, you might actually have been able to empower some legislators to take actions that would have prevented the Vietnam War. And before the U.S. assault on Iraq, the most recent one, you urged anyone who might have papers in his or her safe, you thought there probably was such a person, that could help to prevent that war by revealing secrets that would show the fragility of the official rationale for going to war. You urged them to make those public. I wonder if you have thoughts about the potential that there are nuclear secrets which, if revealed, could strengthen public motivation to work toward full nuclear disarmament and help politicians to move in that direction, and what might be the dangers, since this is such a dangerous technology, of revealing information about the workings of nuclear weapons, U.S. operational plans, anything else in the area of nuclear secrets. Daniel Ellsberg?
Well, I regret very much that I didn't release to the world highly secret documents that I had in 1958, 59, 60, 61, revealing the enormous, unimaginable, really, threat that our then operational plans and posed to the world at large, and still do. Real evidence, for example, that had we carried out our plans as envisioned right then over the Berlin crisis, over the Cuban Missile Crisis, which were real possibilities where these plans had been executed, our own Joint Chiefs of Staff estimated that we would kill, by our effects, some 600 million people. Hard to conceive of such an effect, except it's 100 Holocausts, except that, in fact, they greatly underestimated that effect, because the effects, as I've said, on smoke from those attacks, an effect that was not considered at all, whose actual effect would not be appreciated. The fact that that smoke would be lofted by the explosions into the stratosphere, where it would not be rained out and would remain blocking sunlight for over a decade, that was not known at the time, and has really not penetrated now. So I would like very much, for example, studies to be made within the Pentagon and leaked to the public, or released to the public, on the actual effect of carrying out their plans as envisioned right now. I'm virtually certain that the president himself has never actually been confronted with the effects, the nuclear winter and nuclear famine effects, because the effect of this smoke would be basically to starve people through the elimination of food supplies. I'm sure that no president has ever been really confronted with the effects of that. That is to say that the information that needs to be leaked or released to the public probably has not even been gathered within the Pentagon based on actual plans and actual targeting. Because they don't want to know, actually. They don't want to be confronted themselves with the effects of what they're planning and readying themselves to do under various circumstances. But if such studies do exist, to the extent that they do, I would hope very much that people with access to that would not cooperate in concealing it from the public and from Congress and from the world, but would actually take the personal risks of revealing it, and revealing that our present plans for preemption and for limiting damage by our counterforce weapons, like our land-based ICBMs, that these are essentially fraudulent and have been for a long time. They would not reduce damage at all because of the worldwide effects they would have, including starving the U.S. itself by this effect. So our plans are essentially, as I say, based on a hoax or a fraud that they could be implemented without universal devastation. This needs revealing congressional investigations. It could be inspired by public pressure to investigate this, and that has not happened at all. And that is an area where citizens, I think, could seek a real effect. And by the way, Jenny, you were asking earlier about things beyond voting. I think all the three of us were present recently at Livermore Nuclear Weapons Design Lab to at a demonstration on Hiroshima Day, actually, where 60 people got arrested in acts of nonviolent civil disobedience. I was among those. And I wouldn't be doing that if I didn't feel that that tool was necessary and potentially effective. I felt the effect of such actions on my own life. It wouldn't have occurred to me to take the actions you've mentioned of revealing the top secret Pentagon papers if it weren't for the demonstration of people who were going to prison nonviolently in protest against what they saw as a wrongful war in Vietnam. And I realized that I agreed with them and that their action was powerful. As I say, I felt it myself. And it led me to consider doing something which I wouldn't have thought of otherwise, which did expose me to prison. So I do encourage, that's why I take part in such actions, precisely to encourage others to do so, because I know that they're an essential part of the democratic public process here of influencing our policy.
All three of you have frequently engaged in civil disobedience, the violation of laws and restrictions on the basis of conscience. Looking back at American history, it is, I think, beyond debate that we would not have many of the rights and freedoms that we do have now had there not been willingness on the part of many people to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. And I wonder if Jackie Cavasso and David Hartso, if you could comment, add to what Daniel Ellsberg has said with your own reasons for participating in civil disobedience, for going beyond the strict limits of the law in your citizen organizing and advocacy.
Sure. And I just want to say how absolutely heartening it is to hear Dan's personal testimony on this matter, and to remind us why sometimes risking arrest is so important. I actually do not consider most of my acts of risking arrest to be civil disobedience, and I'll tell you why. In the civil rights movement, people were violating laws that they considered to be unjust, segregation laws. In this case, when we lie down in front of the gate of a nuclear weapons laboratory, we're not actually breaking any laws. But what we are doing is we are calling attention to the fact that laws are being violated inside the fence line, that the people working at the laboratory, the scientists and the engineers, are engaged in planning and preparation for wars of aggression, targeting civilian populations, preparing for genocide, and violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Article 6, which is the disarmament obligation. So that's what motivates me to risk arrest in protest of ongoing maintenance and modernization of nuclear weapons.
You believe that the steps you're taking actually are legal, even though they subject you to arrest. And David Hartso, can you comment on your own experience as well?
Yeah, I just wanted to say also that I thank Dan so much for being willing to speak the truth about the Vietnam War and about nuclear weapons, even though it could have caused him 140 years in prison. We need hundreds of people like Dan Ellsberg that know the truth about what's going on around nuclear weapons production, around plans for wars. Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning should be considered our national heroes. Democracy only works if people know the truth. So we call on many, many people to tell the truth that they know. This happened at Diablo Canyon when over 500 of us were in prison, when Diablo Canyon was about to go online. And here, I think encouraged by our actions, a welder who worked on the plant, exposed to the to PG&E and the whole world, that the blueprint for the cooling pipes for the second reactor had been read upside down. So if that had gone online, it would have been very, very dangerous for millions of people in California. So after getting arrested at Livermore, I was a part of over 300 people down at Los Alamos in New Mexico on Nagasaki Day who had a demonstration there. I think it's just critical if something is going on that we feel is totally insane. The idea of killing hundreds of millions of people, maybe billions of people, for any reason whatsoever, it calls for us to speak out much more strongly than just saying something at the dinner table, or even writing a letter to our congressperson, or writing a letter to the editor of the paper. We have to somehow put our bodies on the line. We have to, our actions trying to stop trains that were carrying bombs to kill people in Central America, Nuremberg actions. We were trying to uphold international law, and I would add God's law, which says thou shalt not kill, and to kill innocent civilians because we might not like their government is not acceptable. And I believe that we are all one human family. I think of myself as a world citizen, not as just an American citizen. So we have a responsibility to all humanity, all our brothers and sisters around the world. And if a policy of our government is threatening to kill thousands or millions of them, we have to do everything in our power nonviolently to try to change that, even if it means spending some time in jail.
We've covered a wide range of topics. When Civil Discourse returns, I will ask my three guests to give us parting statements, take-home messages, to tell us what each of them thinks it's most important for us to remember and have in mind and act on regarding nuclear dangers and the exercise of grassroots power, fundamental democracy, to constrain dangerous actions by government. Please stay with us. You're listening to Civil Discourse on the topic Pathways to a Nuclear-Free Future. My guests are Jackie Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation, Daniel Ellsberg, Senior Fellow of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and David Hartso, Executive Director of Peace Workers and co-founder of the Nonviolent Peace Force. We have 7 or 8 minutes left, and I'd like to invite each of you, Jackie, Daniel, and David, to tell us what you think it's most important for our listeners to take home from this conversation. And if you will, with particular attention to how people can sustain their energy, their spirit, while participating in what seems like such a huge and challenging effort that goes on for many years. Perhaps we could do this in alphabetical order. So starting with you, Jackie Cabasso.
Sure. So as I've been listening to this conversation, we've actually touched on a lot of different issues without explicitly saying we're talking about a lot of different issues. Because I don't believe that nuclear weapons can be approached or thought about as a single issue. They are a symbol or the tip of the spear of a system that is based on gross inequality, fundamentally anti-democratic, and militaristic. And I think we can approach it in a sustained way that's going to be effective. We can't just think we can pluck nuclear weapons out of this system and go on about our merry way without changing things. We have to think about the relationship of nuclear weapons to other really critical issues that are facing people and the planet here in the United States and around the world. I think we need to be motivated by a system of values, not single issues, values of democracy, cooperation, equality, environmental sustainability, and so on. And we need to make common cause and with others who are working on other issues and support their efforts so that they'll support our efforts and we can build a movement of movements, which is what we really need to build the political power necessary to create change.
This is why you refer
and we are
to
not alone.
This is why you refer to yourselves as peace and justice activists. Daniel Ellsberg, concluding comments.
Yes, I'd like to agree with, first of all, with Jackie Cabasso on the ultimate importance and something that we need to start on right now of changing the legitimation of war. I'll summarize some of what we've done here and of militaristic solutions to conflict. But I do want to focus on something we haven't talked about earlier, and that's a quite immediate problem. It has been over 50 years since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and a year before that, the Berlin Crisis, that there was a prospect of U.S. and Russian, or earlier Soviet, troops actually being in armed conflict with each other. It's been half a century. That's happening right now because of the positions that NATO and the U.S. have been taking with respect to Ukraine, and for that matter, Russia. We're confronting each other in Ukraine now, and for the first time, really, ever, both sides have been talking about their readiness and their feeling that they are legitimately able to make threats of using nuclear weapons if necessary in that conflict. Now, these are threats of world destruction. These are essentially insane threats, which are being made explicitly, as they say, in this case, by both sides. It's really essential, I think, for people at large to realize, on the first hand, the doomsday implications of such threats, and what immediately follows, their entire illegitimacy for this being an instrument of political life here on Earth, the instrument of threatening and readying and being prepared to initiate nuclear war. I do think that we are approaching, specifically in the Ukraine, which we haven't mentioned earlier, conflict, a possibility of world destruction that we have not seen for over half a century since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And this is something where I think citizens at large can very well weigh in, as they did, as David Hartzell mentioned earlier, 2 years ago, in saying we don't want war, U.S. war with Syria, which was a very, very wise and effective pressure on Congress and in turn on the president, who in this case elicited cooperation from the Russian leader, Putin, to get the gas out of Syria as a weapon. Well, there is a demonstration of actual public process having effect, and we need that right now for people to be telling our Congress and the world that it is absolutely unacceptable for them to be threatening the first use of nuclear weapons, as is happening right at this moment.
And David Hartzell, your concluding comments.
Well, thank you, Jamie. It's been great to be a part of this conversation. I think I agree totally with Dan. All people that are concerned need to let their members of Congress and the administration know that threatening a war over Ukraine is absolutely tragic and stupid and could lead to a nuclear war. Similarly, they need to contact their members of Congress around the Iran diplomatic agreement, that be supported rather than threatening to go to war. I would hope that people will weigh in on this $1 trillion that is planned to be used for modernizing nuclear weapons over the next 30 years, that we can think of much better ways to spend those resources in our schools and our communities and making the transition to renewable energy world. And for your listeners in New Mexico, $2 billion a year is going to the Los Alamos labs and I think even additional to the Sandia base for modernizing our nuclear weapons and developing those nuclear weapons, building the nuclear weapons. That money, you know what could be, what the needs are of the people in New Mexico, one of the poorest states in the country. And it's not for building bombs that can kill millions of people. And I think, as has also been said, war as a way of resolving conflict needs to be challenged. It is not working, and we're digging ourselves deeper and deeper in a hole making more and more enemies. And instead, let's join the world's people in saying no to war and militarism and threatening weapons of mass destruction. And what we could do with that $2 trillion a year, which the world is spending on war and preparations for war, to build a decent life for every person on the planet, which would make us so much, much more secure than modernizing our nuclear weapons.
This has been a very rich discussion. Our topic on this edition of Civil Discourse was Pathways to a Nuclear-Free Future, and you can learn more about the involvement of New Mexicans in nuclear weapons work and some consequences of research and management of nuclear weapons and material in New Mexico by attending a forum on Nuclear New Mexico Past and Future that will be held on Thursday, August 20th, 2015 at 6 p.m. in the Miller Library at Western New Mexico University. I'm very grateful to my three guests for speaking to the listeners of Gila Mimbres Community Radio. Thank you, Jackie Cabasso.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you, Daniel Ellsberg.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, David Hartsoe.
Thank you, Jamie. Good to be on your program.
And thanks to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson, and to the members and supporters of Gila Mimbres Community Radio for making this program possible. Finally, I want to thank you, the listeners, for listening to Civil Discourse, the public affairs program of Gila Mimbres Community Radio. I'm your host, Jamie Newton.